Kevin's been reading ahead. His prayer was about our class today and this morning and for the sermon as well, is that the writer of Hebrews has laid some very foundational principles that we need to have in our lives as well as the lives of those early first century Jewish Christians. And when we get to chapter 6, at the end of chapter 5, it's time that we need to be moving on to stronger things. And we're going to have that encouragement. We'll talk about that a little bit in class today. We'll dwell on it sometime this morning in our sermon. So we're in Hebrews chapter 5 for the class today. And if I could have somebody read verses 1 through 4 to get us started, that would be great.
For every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray, since he himself is also subject to weakness. because of this, he is required, as for the people, so also for himself, to offer sacrifices for sin. And no man takes this honor to himself, but he who is called by God, just as Aaron was.
Okay, just so pretty much how we've started every week in our study of Hebrews, the chapter begins with which word? Generally begins with therefore, but there's another derivative of that that can be used as well, and it's the word what?
For.
So again, let's do this like we've done the last few weeks. Chapter 5, verse 1 starts out with the word for, which means that it's attached to the verses preceding that, or the chapter preceding that. And so, what is the subject matter in the preceding chapter that we're supposed to take on as a continuance into chapter 5?
Christ is the high priest.
Christ is the high priest. And that begins in chapter 14. So you may have found it just a little bit odd last week that we didn't talk a whole lot about verses 14, 15, and 16. In my mind, those fit closer to chapter 5 than they do to chapter 4. What was the context and the main thrust, though, of chapter 4 before we get into 14, 15, and 16? What did we talk about last week a lot?
Rest.
All right. And so the writer came and he established the principle and the concept that God is always prepared and preparing a place of rest for the people who are obedient to him. And what were the different phases that we talked through briefly that he has done that? What were the time periods or time eras that God provided rest?
Well, after the creation.
The creation. We talked about how God rested and he modeled that resting period. He's the Lord of the Sabbath. He created the rest and was to model it for us and build it in. What was another time of rest?
Their Sabbath day. Right?
Their Sabbath day. What was another one from chapter 4?
Promised land.
The promised land. So they wandered in the wilderness, and it was all to get to finally a place where they could rest and take comfort in their souls. What was the third one?
Eternal
rest was in there as well. That's specifically to us in verses 9 and 10. Therefore, there remains for us a place of rest, the people of God. What were the two others before that? Well, verse 8, Joshua could have given the people rest because he took the people into the promised land. But he said, you know, afterward there would be another day. And then David, after him, said, today, if you will not harden your hearts, the Lord will give rest. All these times of rest. Then we move into verse 14, 15, 16, and it changes gears and it talks about the high priest. So Bob has just read for us the connecting verse here. For every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men in thanks pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. What we're going to talk about this morning is the nature of the office of the high priest. There are certain aspects, certain roles, certain functions of that. We're going to talk about the obligations, a number of different things. Back up one here. These are the things I want to hit on today in our class. Is I want to talk a little bit about the succession of the high priest, the appointment, the purpose, and finally the qualifications. And so, where did the whole concept of a high priest come from in the Bible? What was the starting point?
God appointing Aaron.
All right, and Bob hit it right on the head here. God is the one who appointed Aaron. And what was going on at that time? What was the context?
It was the establishment of the old covenant, the tabernacle, and the worship, and the whole Old Testament.
All right, so this is the time we're wandering the wilderness. Moses is receiving the commandments. He receives the law that was written by God. And then we had to have a mediator, somebody to be able to help the people understand the law and to take their offerings and their gifts and their sacrifices and present those to God to help bridge the gap between the two. So it was first given to Aaron and his sons following the establishment of the Mosaic Covenant. And they were the human representatives for God of offerings, of thankfulness and sacrifices, and also on behalf of the entire nation as well. So let's talk a little bit to begin with about succession. Look at verse 1 again. For every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men in things pertaining to God. So if it says that every high priest, what does that mean? Does it mean that we just have one that lives forever? Not in the Mosaic Covenant. If it says every high priest, it means that we had a succession. They did not live forever. They were bone of bone, flesh of flesh, partakers of our nature, just like we are. And they had to be replaced year after year. How long could they fulfill the role as high priest? Was it a two-year term, a four-year term?
I think it was for life, once they were appointed.
I'd look to see if there was kind of any guidelines as far as how long they were to serve. And it seemed that some of them served till death, and maybe some of them served till they relinquished that authority, but generally until they died.
I think there was a maximum time.
I couldn't find it. It may be.
But I think there was a minimum age, and I think there was a maximum age also.
Okay. I could certainly see maybe kind of a minimum age of making sure that they were wise enough and had the maturity, similar to the leadership that we have in the church today. But when I was looking through, and I didn't spend a whole lot of time, but I couldn't find kind of a cap on the age on the upper end. All right. Any other thoughts on succession? It was pretty basic, but I just wanted to establish the concept that it was one after another, and that it was God, number two, that did the appointing. So, this was not a campaign. All the time on TV right now, what are we seeing?
Campaigns.
I want to be the president of the United States. We've got 12 people or so dropping down, whittling down the list, and they're all saying, I want to be the one who's in charge. I want to be the president. And this office of the high priest is nothing like a campaign. It is God appointing the right person to take this role, because it is a very serious role to be had. Now, as we move farther on down the line, we're talking about in Christ's time, what did the high priest come to be more like? Well, that was more like a campaign, I think. You had Caiaphas, you had all these other people who saw this as a position of power and authority and mingling it with the government to leverage their will on the people. And that's not how God set up the office of high priest in the Old Testament. Any other comments or thoughts on the appointment process?
I appreciate the purity of the way God would have set it up. How long do you think it took for a man to mess it up, though? I mean, you're kind of portraying the high priest as being this very holy person, which they should have been.
Yeah.
But they weren't guiding the people that was particularly holy. And part of the reason was because there was lack of holiness in the priest at times, too.
They were not perfect people, right?
Did you come up with an example of that succession as, like, who followed Aaron?
I didn't go through and kind of track those along. Anybody else?
Tells us. I can't even remember who the next high priest was.
Well, he had sons.
Yeah.
He had several sons. Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, I think was one. And we see that even his sons, you know, couldn't keep the pattern and follow on. God, you know, he created this one-way street for access to him. Now for us, it's through Christ. But in the Old Testament, if you needed to approach God and give a sacrifice or a gift or an offering to him, whose hands did that have to go through? If you had a sacrifice, a lamb or a bull or some other type of item like that, that had to go through the high priest's hands, and he had to inspect it, like we talked about last week. The ability of Christ to come in and cut open that sacrifice and to see the heart and to see if it was pure. Verse 4, we find a little bit more about the appointment process. And no man takes this honor to himself, but he who is called by God, just as Aaron was. This man was entrusted on both sides. He had to be entrusted from the people, but he also had to be entrusted by God to make that intercession for them. So, I referenced them already, but Numbers chapter 16 is the story of the rebellion at Korah. And so we've got Korah, we've got Dathan and Abiram self-appointed themselves. And what happened whenever they rebelled and said, we're going to be the ones that the people should follow and make the intercession for them? What happened?
I'm swallowed them up.
All right. And so how many of them died that day?
250,
I think, is what I had in my notes. 250. Because they tried to appoint themselves. God takes this very seriously. This is a role that is set apart. It is a very special role. And as we think about our position today as being priests, not high priests, but priests, we are likewise appointed. We are brought in to God's fold by His blessings and by the blood of Christ. Let's talk a little bit about the purpose now of the high priest. Look at what it says in, it's still in verse 1. He's appointed for men and things pertaining to God. It's his prerogative to choose and to have this person, that he may offer what? Two things.
Gifts and sacrifices.
So in my mind, I've always just kind of assumed that when people brought things to the high priest, it was always to sacrifice something for their sins, to make atonement, to make things right for sin. But there's another aspect of that as well, and it's gifts. People would bring gifts to the high priest as well in thankfulness to God. Not necessarily because they've sinned, but because they're thankful and they recognize the fact that all of their blessings have come from who?
God.
They've come from God. And so it's right for me to take that back to God and to show Him my appreciation. I think there's a good message in that system right there for us when we think about our giving on the first Lord's Day of the week. We don't just come and be thankful for all of our sins that Christ has sacrificed His life for. Yes, that's a great role that Christ as our high priest can handle. But after that, we come and we also give our gifts. And we lay them before the altar.
Yeah, I got a question. Would the gifts then be used by the priesthood, or would they actually be burned up on the altar?
Well, I think some of them were to be used. Obviously, they had some of their tithes and some of their other offerings that were meant to help sustain and take care of the priest. But I would say that there were probably others that were offered as sacrifices.
Where the priest got their food and their money or whatever they got was from the offerings.
Okay. Now, there are some things that they gave as a gift that weren't necessarily burned on an altar or used as currency so that they could sustain themselves. What did Hannah do in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and 3? Who did she bring to the altar?
Her son.
She said, I'm going to bring my son Samuel to the high priest, and I'm going to dedicate him or give him as an offering to God. I want him to be set aside and show you just how thankful I am for what you have given me. And we see that kind of played out in a lot of churches today. Is they'll make a more of a memorial type of a process where a family might bring up a young child, and the parents will say, we want to dedicate, and we want to make sure that our son or our daughter is in service to the Lord. We're thankful for that. It's kind of a dedication service, I think some people
talk
call
about
it.
A real definition of sacrifice. That was it.
Yeah.
She had been praying. She wanted a child. And then when she got him, gave him away.
Yeah. And see, that's completely different from the dedications that we see today. That's just more of a kind of a public type of a deal. She was saying, you take him, he's yours, and I want him to live a life that is holy and set apart. So gifts and sacrifices were the two things that the priests were supposed to do. That was part of the purpose. Any other comments on the purpose of the high priest? All right, let's talk about the qualifications. Can somebody read verse 2, please?
He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness.
All right. So, New King James, I think you just say gentle, have compassion.
He shall deal gently.
Deal gently or have compassion on two different types of people. And what are the two different types of people that the high priest is going to have compassion and be gentle with?
Those that didn't know any better, and then those that did, but sinned anyway.
All right. So if you were a Jew living in the Old Testament, your entire life and righteousness depended upon you knowing the law. If you were going to keep the law and the requirements of it, you had to know it. And there were going to be some people who just did not invest the time, or were younger or more immature, I don't know. They were ignorant of some of those laws, and the list was lengthy. And so the high priest was one to help those and have compassion on those who didn't know all of them, but then also on those who have gone astray, who have known the law, maybe for a long time, and have decided, I've tasted it, but I don't really like the way it tastes anymore, so I'm going to go after something else.
I think that word, too, to deal gently or whatever, however else it's translated, really means it's not harsh, but also it's not soft.
I did read that in one area. I read it as in moderation, in one place, is that it's not overly gushing with emotion and weeping about these things all the time, and it's not so stern and firm that there's no in between, but it's having the right balance and knowing the people well enough to help them through.
It's like in Numbers 30, chapter 30, maybe verse 13 or somewhere in there. It kind of gives that definition.
I'll read just a verse here. In Leviticus chapter 5, we find out about this situation of dealing with the ignorant. Leviticus 5, 2. Or if any person touches any unclean thing, whether it is the carcass of an unclean beast, or the carcass of an unclean livestock, or the carcass of an unclean creeping things, and he is unaware of it, he shall also be unclean and guilty. I touched this dead thing, and I didn't even really know about it. An unintentional or an ignorant type of sin. But then there's also the type that is very intentional. In Leviticus chapter 6, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, if a person sins and commits a trespass against the Lord by lying to his neighbor, and what was delivered to him for safekeeping or a pledge or about a robbery, or if he has extorted from his neighbor, or if he has found what was lost and lies concerning and swears falsely, in any of these things a man may do in which he sins, then it shall be because he has sinned and is guilty, he shall restore what's stolen, and he shall be extorted, or what was delivered for safekeeping, the loss which he found. And it goes on, and he shall bring his trespass offering to the Lord, a ram without blemish from the flock, with your valuation as a trespass offering to the priest. So this is an intentional type of a sin, and the high priest had to deal with both of those things. So he had to be qualified and be somebody who was gentle and had the compassion to deal with both of those types of sins. In addition to being compassionate, what else did the high priest have to be? Well, look at what it says at the end of verse 2. Since he himself is also subject to weakness. In verse 3, because of this, because he is weak and sinful like the people, he is required, as for the people, as for himself, to offer sacrifices for sins. So to be a high priest, not only did you have to have compassion, but you also had to have weaknesses and sin. You had to be flesh and bone, just like the people, to understand the challenges they were going through. They were not perfect people. We talk about Aaron's two sons in Leviticus 10. They were not obedient. And when they had to be punished, Aaron wasn't even allowed to mourn for their death. All right. Any other comments on the qualifications?
I think these verses, and you've zeroed in on them, but I've just got marked down six different qualifications for a priest, and they come from verses 1 and 2. They're chosen from among men,
okay.
Appointed by God, to act on behalf of men, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin, to deal gently with, and to be a person who knows weaknesses himself.
Okay.
So, you know, he's using all of this because the Jews, he's talking to the Jews, they're very familiar with this. And he's saying, hey, we've got a priest that is superior to this.
All right, so Dwayne picked up on it. We're ready to now make the transition. This book, the writer is penning this letter to Jewish Christians who have converted, and they are well-versed in the Old Testament law. And so he takes an opportunity here and says, now, I want to remind everybody what you know about the Old Testament and the high priest system, and I want to use that, but now let's make a transition, because I want to get your mind prepped and primed to think about Christ and how he is so much better than that, as he was Moses, as he was the angels. So what does he say? Somebody read verse 5. Actually, let's read 5 through 9, please.
So also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you. As he also says in another place, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications, with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear, though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him.
All right. So here's kind of what I had. I know that's awful small. If you can't read it, scoot up closer, or I'll help you through it. We've got a comparison now made in the chapter about the Mosaic priesthood and the qualifications, the responsibilities, the roles, and the things that they performed on the right. And then we've got the comparison to Jesus. And the writer goes through and he lists several of those things. So they were both the Son of Man, right? A descendant of Levi in the Old Testament, and a descendant of Judah. Christ came through Judah. And he was born a Son of Man. He fulfilled that. He was appointed. It says Aaron was appointed by God, and that you don't appoint yourself. Who was it that appointed Christ to this role? God the Father. What do we find in Matthew chapter 3?
This is my son, hear ye him.
There you go. So, again, I couldn't quite figure out how long they served. I didn't know if it was till death or whatever is why I got a question mark there. But how long does Jesus serve in the role of high priest?
Forever.
Forever. We don't have a succession. He finished it all. Sacrifices. High priest offered a sacrifice for the people. Did Christ just offer any old sacrifice, any old burnt offering?
Himself.
Could you give a better sacrifice than yourself? No.
The only difference is he didn't have to offer a sacrifice for himself.
No, because he was perfect, right?
Right.
The sacrifice was supposed to be from sin in your life. And I think that that's what kind of ties in with the passage about how he learned obedience because of his sufferings as well. We'll touch on that in just a minute. Yeah. Access to God. It was through the high priest that those people had the interaction and could have their voices heard to the Lord. And when Jesus died, he was the one that went in through the veil, just like they did in the Old Testament, and had access to the throne room of God. The mediating. They had to continually mediate, standing daily, ministering. And Christ brings us and reconciles us to the throne himself. And then the last one, the righteousness. The high priest was set apart and strove to perfection. He had a white turban on his head and a gold band around the turban. And anybody remember what was written on that golden turban? Holy to the Lord. Just to make sure that everybody in that high priest knew that one was set apart, the term holy. Remember we talked about being set apart to the Lord. And Christ, obviously, was perfected through his obedience to the Father's will. So I think this is a good comparison that we need to keep in our mind about how Christ is so much better than the Old Testament high priest. Alright, so we've got a few other points here in the last 10 minutes that I want to go through. And those come in starting in verse 7. Look at what it says. Who in the days of his flesh. First of all, I want you to notice that Christ was on this earth for how long?
33 years.
About 30 years or so. We could count by the days, particularly his ministry, his last 3 years. He was reckoning his life and his time by days. It was so important that he get this right every day, day in and day out. And likewise, we need to reckon our lives by the day. Live the Christian life daily, taking up our cross and following him. Who in the days of his flesh, he took on the flesh to experience this human life and have all the sufferings. When he offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries, tears. When I see prayers, supplications, vehement cries, and tears coming from Christ, where do you think my mind goes to? What place? I think I go to Gethsemane and Calvary. How desperately he was agonizing in pain about what he was going to go through, but knew that he had to suffer through that to be obedient. And he was praying to God, if it's your will, let this cup pass from me. But what does it say at the end of verse 7? It says, God, who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear. So Christ was praying to God, if it's possible to save me from this, you know, to let this cup pass, you know, that would be great. But if it's your will that I need to go through with it, then I'm going to go through. But look at what it says at the end of verse 7. And I kind of got my mind quite wrapped around this. Was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his godly fear. I found that an interesting way to put that. Christ is God himself. Why would we need to... Why would the writer need to describe that as godly fear?
Maybe the word reverence might fit just a little bit better than because of his reverence. I mean, yeah, it was fear, but I mean, he knew God better than any of us. But he didn't.
Okay.
He was God.
So more of a reverence toward him. Any other thoughts about Christ having godly fear right before his death?
Mine says his piety.
His piety? Okay, that's a good term. We don't use that one very often today.
Well, as a human, do you think he would have been tempted to not go through with this?
Absolutely. What human would want to go through a Roman crucifixion?
Do you think there would have been there was a knowledge of the blowing up of the planet, if you will, and all the consequences?
I think, I guess what Kevin's probably getting at is, I think it demonstrates the true humanity of Christ in this aspect that he knows what he's got to go through, he knows the difficulty that's in front of him, and he's afraid.
But he has to agree with Wayne in terms of reverence. I'm not at all
yeah.
going in another direction, but I'm just saying, we're not trying to totally go away.
Yeah.
But if we take it in the fear sense, I think there would be components.
But it's the right type of fear. It's a godly fear.
Yeah, Bob? It gives him a tremendous respect for obedience. That this is by far the toughest thing I'm going to have to go through. And he was scared, like all of us would be. And yet, he had this tremendous feeling to be obedient.
That phrase to me, that whole phrase we're looking at, I think is basically saying the answer was no.
Yeah,
I prayed. But the answer was no, and that's okay.
And I accepted that.
I accept that.
You know, and Christ is—he's praying for himself to make it through this. But who else does he pray for during this time in Gethsemane before the cross? The people, the apostles, his mother, just like the high priest in the Old Testament, they weren't perfect, like Christ was perfect, and they had to pray and cleanse themselves as well as give a prayer for the people. Christ, although he was sinless, is still praying for the strength and praying for those who would follow after him. Verse 8 we kind of touched on a little bit in the weeks prior. Though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. Okay, so in Luke chapter 2, we find that Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men, and he was growing and learning at that time. How do we reconcile that with the fact that he is God? You know, was he an entitled son who, because he was the son of a king, that he shouldn't have to go through all these things? Or did he have to learn them just like everybody else did?
in order for him to be this great high priest, he had to experience these things. Demonstrate how to go through.
I think that word learn is talking about his human side.
Okay.
Because as on the spiritual side, he didn't have to learn anything. But the human side, he had to learn.
He did. And what's interesting is that was Christ ever disobedient? No. For us, we generally learn things through sometimes our mistakes and our disobedience. Christ didn't learn through his mistakes because he didn't have any. He was never disobedient, yet he learned perfect obedience when he did what? What was the capstone of his learning obedience?
Going all the way to death.
Even to the death on the cross. Alright, so I think he left us an example that we should learn by our sufferings and afflictions a humble obedience to the will of God. We learn through those sufferings. And Christ learned and was perfected through that suffering on the cross.
Get the example of Job, who was a very godly man, obeying God in so many ways. But yet the devil basically said, well, but if he hadn't really suffered, he probably would have obeyed. So, I mean, it's kind of just a similar idea here, probably. Job demonstrated, you use the word complete or perfect.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what we're talking about, complete, full obedience.
I think it's the true way to find out if you are truly a child of God and obedient to Him, is to be put to the test. We talked about going up in the airplane and, you know, are you going to trust? Are you going to be obedient enough to jump out of that plane and fight that fight? Verse 9, having been perfected, He became the author of our eternal salvation to all who would obey Him. This being made perfect. This is what I go back to a few weeks ago when I was talking about consecration and propitiation. We talked about the term propitiation in an ink pen. You know, the whole reason that this pen was created was to write on the piece of paper. The reason for Christ coming to earth was to be the Savior, to author salvation and to die. And He did exactly what He was sent here and came to do. The perfect propitiation for sins. This is how Jesus, I was trying to think of a good way to describe this, but He was made perfect by His sufferings and His perfect obedience. He was consecrated, you know, we talk about the consecration process, by His sufferings and by His own blood is how He was consecrated. So as you think about the Old Testament and the high priest, how did the high priest consecrate things back in that day?
Washed them,
cleaned them off, but then they also consecrated them in, with the blood. So when we think about Christ being that high priest and being consecrated, I think about not wearing a scarlet robe like we looked at the picture of the high priest back in that day. What was the robe that Christ wore? He had a purple Roman robe that he put on. And what covered that robe on the inside? His blood. Because he was whipped all over his back. And he had this robe put on him. So we have this picture of this high priest in Christ wearing this robe, covered in blood. He was perfectly consecrated because of his sufferings. He was the true propitiation for our sins. The perfect fulfillment.
I like that word perfect, and so many times in the scriptures I like to use like a definition of reach the designated end.
Okay.
To reach a designated end.
And so what is
it's about end.
What's another definition of sin? You know, I've heard it described a few times as shooting the bow and arrow, and the designated end is the bullseye, is that target. And if you shoot and you drill the bullseye, you have done what Christ did. You reached the designated end. But the term sinning means to do what? To miss the mark. Good point there. The last one that I've got here in the last minute or so is, again, verse 9. Having been perfected, reaching the designated end, He became the author of eternal salvation to all who would obey Him. Has anybody else given some thought? We use that term quite a bit. Christ is the author and finisher of our faith. What does Christ being the author really mean? What does it mean when we say that Christ is the author of our faith?
Living the
Say that again, Larry.
Living the story.
Living the story. Okay. So would we have the gospel story? Would we have salvation without Christ? No. It's all about Him. He is the cause or the reason for the message, the good news. Good point, Larry. Any other comments on that, being the author?
That was what I was going to say. That word cause, I think, really tells what author is.
Okay. And He's the purpose, the cause, the author for who?
To those who obey Him.
To those who obey Him. All right. So He gives the invitation to all people, right? The invitation goes out to everyone, but salvation belongs to who?
Obedient.
The obedient. To those who obey Him. Verse 9. So
I've heard people, I've read where people believe that everybody in the world will be saved because Jesus made this great sacrifice. But it's pretty obvious that His salvation is only for those who obey Him.
And is this a one-time obedience or a continuing obedience?
All right, so we're gonna get into that a little bit in the weeks to come. But this is, you know, we talk about a primary obedience to Christ, but then it's ongoing obedience to Him, to stay in that fold, to stay in the kingdom. And the writer, that's part of the whole purpose of the book of Hebrews, is to encourage these Jewish Christians not to give in. Don't fall away. Don't drift. Don't give in to the Roman pressures and persecutions that you're starting to suffer and punt and give up on your faith. Hold strong. Be firm to the end. I'm showing you Christ and just what He's done for you as a high priest. Obey Him. Eddie?
Also among their own brethren, the ones who wanted to stay with Moses' law.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your comments. I'm on for the sermon today, so guess what we're going to talk about? Hebrews chapter 6. I'm going to try to get in as much time as we can, and maybe in 3 years from now we'll get through the rest of the book. Thank you for your help.